Hej och välkomna till veckans avsnitt av Red Eye After Hours. Vi har idag den stora äran att bli gästade av vdn för Media & Games Invest, Remco Westerman. Det är ett av våra klientbolag. Bolaget har även ingått i vår modellportfölj Red Eye Top Picks. Det dubbelnoterades på Stockholmsbörsen oktober 2020 med stor framgång och stiger med 60% sedan dess. Som mest så var utvecklingen 450% efter dubbelnoteringen. Men ja, värderingen har ju kommit ner på sistone. Men bolaget har förvärvat över 35 bolag med stor framgång. Intäkterna har växt med 69% CAGR sedan 2018 och med 67% EBITDA CAGR under samma period. Och de har som minst haft en 50% i intäktstillväxt sedan 2018.
Mm. Och det är ju väldigt spännande nu, för att vi har ju vår första externa gäst i podden.
Mm.
Och att ta med Remco här, som bjuder faktiskt väldigt mycket på sig nu, för att vi spelar in det här introt i efterhand.
Mm.
Och vad vi kan avslöja egentligen redan nu, det är att han bjuder väldigt mycket på sig själv, och som vi har en del av vår ratingmodell, People. Nu kommer vi verkligen in på personen här för Media Games Invest och förstår mer om honom.
Ja, alltså People är ju en viktig del av Red Eyes ratingmodell, men det vet ju alla, att som Remco även kommer säga i intervjun, att People är det viktigaste i ett bolag, och han är väl den viktigaste personen på Media & Games Invest som både vd, styrelseordförande, vilket han inte kommer vara framöver i och med att de kommer flytta sätet till Sverige, så han ska steppa ner där. Men han äger också 26% av kapitalet i bolaget, så han är ju den enskilt viktigaste personen i bolaget, och därför tänkte vi att det är väldigt viktigt att komma under skinnet på honom och lära känna honom mer som person. Vill man lära sig mer om bolaget så kan man lyssna på kapitalmarknadsdagen, om man vill grotta ner mer i siffrorna.
Eller läsa din analys här, Danne, även om du vill vara lite ödmjuk.
Ja, men okej, man kan läsa min analys också och uppdateringen på bolaget. Men hur känner du efter intervjun? Jag är som sagt analytiker för bolaget, och disclaimer, jag äger också aktier i bolaget. Mm. Så jag har ju en viss syn på bolaget redan. Men du som kanske inte har lika mycket koll på bolaget, vad är dina reflektioner från intervjun?
Min reflektion är egentligen att Remco var väldigt intressant att intervjua. Det var väldigt mycket som man tror aldrig vi skulle få höra annars om man inte tog upp det i ett sånt här sammanhang. Man har inte fått höra det på någon presentation, han har varit någon annanstans. De är väldigt aktiva på investor relations-biten.
Mm.
Och jag har mer förståelse för det just nu, för att som han är inne på och pratar sen, och kommer att höra att AdTech, som är en stor del av Media & Games Invest, att investera i Sverige eller Europa inte förstår det.
Mm.
Så att jag har fått mer förståelse för hur de agerar och vad de pratar om och varför de gör det. Mm. Och personen bakom hela bolaget.
Ja, jag lärde mig faktiskt en hel del nya grejer om Remco också, och hans bakgrund som jag tycker är väldigt relevanta för caset, i och med att man ändå ryggar då en person som äger en stor del av bolaget och som rattar hela bolaget.
Ja, har visionen.
Exakt. Så jag tycker det var jätteintressant själv.
Mm. Men då ska vi inte dra ut det längre, utan då hoppar vi rätt in i intervjun och välkomna in Remco Westerman i studion. Hi and welcome, Remco Westerman, CEO of Media & Games Invest. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you very much and happy to be here, to be in the studio first time actually.
We thought we'd kick off this conversation by talking a little bit about your background and your history, a little bit about yourself basically. We would love to get to know you a bit better and for our listeners to get to know you a bit better.
Yeah, cool.
Start off like, what's your background and history? I mean, you can start from wherever you want.
And then let's start at the beginning. Born in Holland, so Dutch nationality. Then in German kindergarten for 4 years. Then back to Holland. So I've always been between Holland and Germany. I did my high school exam actually in Germany, south of Germany.
So, but how come you traveled between the two places?
My father had jobs in different companies, and for that moved countries, moved cities.
And what did he do?
He was an engineer, the lights of car, basic car lighting. He did a lot.
So automotive engineering.
Yes, right.
In Germany, yeah, that's a big industry.
Yeah. he started in Holland actually with light bulbs and this kind of stuff. So it's tunnel lightning and these kind of things. So yeah.
So and then yeah, sorry for interrupting. So and then you, so you traveled between Germany and Holland, and where did you go to university?
I went to university in Holland then, Erasmus University in Rotterdam, studying economics. And because it got a bit boring, I did also Japanese studies part of it, because Japan at that time was really very big. And also did a study trip to Japan, and that's also where I got my passion for Asia, basically, because traveling back via China after that. And so I've been a lot in Asia, I seen a lot of things there.
It is similar to me. I studied Chinese because I felt like China was growing that much and going to that. But I also like Japanese and Asia in general.
Yeah, and the food is good. It's also China.
Food is awesome.
Yeah, Japanese food is, it's crazy good. Yeah. So and how was that experience? Like, how long did that situation basically keep up? We're traveling between Holland and Germany while growing up.
Yeah, let's say I was based for a while first in Holland, then in Germany, then in Holland again, then in Germany, and then I did my university in Holland.
Okay.
And from that, during university, I did already work for companies. I did Japanese studies, did consulting, or let's say, and with a professor together, we did consulting for companies. And that also brought me to my first job, which was also in Holland, working for Kuwait Petroleum, an oil company.
Mm-hmm.
Starting as a business analyst, which was a very nice job because you saw a lot of company from selling base oils from the refinery towards doing an integration project with McKinsey. So really, really diverse, very nice first job to start with.
Ah, okay. And was it different cultures like between Holland and Germany, or is it quite similar? I mean, it's neighboring countries and so forth.
Yeah, they're neighboring countries, but the culture is very, very different. Not as different compared to China, of course, but cultures are different. Dutch, I think, are a bit more spontaneous, flexible. And in Germany, I was in Bavaria, just out of where people are really friendly, but it's all a bit more stiff, different.
More bureaucratic?
I would say, yes. Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
And you live in Germany now, right?
I live in Germany now, yes.
And where are you situated? Because I know Media and Games Invest, you have offices in Berlin, in Hamburg, and a couple of places in the world, actually. But where are you situated?
No, I moved to, I had several jobs in Holland and then moved to Germany when I worked for Sonera, the Finnish telecom. And they had an office already in Düsseldorf, which was not doing the value-add service that I did, but it was easy to also move to Düsseldorf. So that's when I moved, early 2000, I moved to Düsseldorf. And having kids, they go to school. So I'm basically, got stuck in Düsseldorf, which is a very nice city, by the way.
And you have a German wife?
Or? I have a Dutch wife.
Dutch wife, okay.
Yeah. So we moved there. When the youngest kid, we have two boys.
Mm-hmm.
And when the youngest kid was 6 months, we took the boys and the family to Germany.
So, and you've been in Germany since then?
And I've been since then, yes.
Oh, okay.
22 years now. So it's, but I'm, I still feel more Dutch. So if there's a football game, it's more that I'm in favor of Holland. But it's, but it's a very good, Düsseldorf is a great city to live. Germany is really a nice country also to live.
But do you miss home?
Yeah, it's so close. It's Düsseldorf is 50 kilometers from the border.
Yeah.
So if you want to go there, we still have, of course, a lot of friends there. And so it's for us. I mean, Holland is not a big country. If you drive to Rotterdam, Amsterdam, it's like 2 hours drive to.
Okay. Oh, so you visit home often.
Yeah, that's whatever home is indeed. But it's Düsseldorf is our home now.
So you live in Düsseldorf now as well?
Yes.
So how close is that to either of your offices in Berlin and Hamburg? Is it far?
They're similar distance. Hamburg is 400 kilometers. Berlin is 500 kilometers. But Düsseldorf has a very convenient airport. So it's 50 minutes flight, which at the moment with the chaos at the airports is a bit challenging. So I'm taking the train mostly now. But it is, and Hamburg and Berlin are also, even by fast train, more than 2 hours apart. So it's a pretty good circle that I do. And we have, of course, a lot of offices now all around the world. Big office in New York, office in Carlsbad near San Diego, but also in Asia, in South America. Mm. So it's, yeah, I do a lot of things also digitally. Mm. And not to forget, naturally, of course, the Sweden here.
Yeah.
We have, the companies here, people here, and also a lot of investors that we like to visit.
And you mentioned your dad was an engineer. I have a background as an engineer as well. You did not follow him in his footsteps. You said you studied economics. Yeah. Did you always have an interest in business and numbers and finance? Or?
Yeah, I thought a long time about also doing a study. I was thinking about building bridges and these kind of things. But I was a bit afraid of the length of the projects. I like to get some speed in things. And some dynamics and building a bridge or something takes really years. So that's the reason that in the end I said, okay, let me study economics. It's a very flexible study. You can do a lot of things with it. Mm. It's a good basis. Then I did a bit of Japanese studies on top. And from there it started.
From the first job at working in this petroleum company, where did you progress then?
Yeah, the petroleum company said after being business analyst to really make a career in the in the petroleum, I was supposed to manage fuel stations, and that were jobs that take 2 years and you drive every day to a lot of fuel stations. So I thought, okay, that's not for me. And then applied for a job with a consultancy, Adstrat, and became a consultant, doing strategy consulting first. And then because strategy consulting is nice, but we worked for the, let's say, top 50 Dutch companies. But there's, you make a report for a CEO or for the top team. A lot of them are not implementing it. It's a bit vague to do strategy. And so at a certain point, I started to do all the restructuring cases, the mergers. So I headed the restructuring practice. So that was much more fun. For me, I mean, it's not always nice because you have to lay off people. But it's about making a company healthy again, making it really future oriented. So that's strategy is nice. I like strategy. Yeah. It's a challenge, but it's much more much more result oriented to do the restructuring part.
That experience, the job you spoke about, must be really relevant for Media and Games Invest later on, since you did a lot of M&A and restructuring and improvement, your strategy being integrate, build and improve, or what's the name of the strategy?
No, that's right. But both of it actually were. The one, the strategic part is really about how do you build a company, and we have done in the in building MGI quite some, I think, unusual things. So doing the pivot from gaming to media, which is strategically making a lot of sense. But it's really a strategic game plan that we developed. And on the other hand, we started with a restructuring case, which was Camigo, the company that we bought. Because we didn't have a lot of money in the beginning, we also bought more companies that were restructuring cases. So we've done a lot of restructuring, keeping the healthy parts of the company and cutting the costs around it. And that was building the basis of this company. So both experiences are really helpful for what we did here.
Yeah, it just seems tailored tailored for that.
That's probably a product of what Media and Games Invest is today.
It's beta success, I would say, of it. It's a combination. If you look at Media and Games Invest, I'm doing this now for 10 years, or October, it's 10 years. And it started with buying a distressed company, Gamigo, where the original idea actually was to just buy it, restructure it, and then go on holiday. I wanted to do a sabbatical, but it didn't work out like that. Then we restructured, got it profitable, and I had something like, hey, I can do a sabbatical now. I can sell it and do a sabbatical, but then I want to do something else then again. So it's rather you have already something really great. So build on that rather than start again.
Interesting.
So I skipped my holiday and started doing an M&A, so buying more similar companies as Camigo and putting them together, and by that building a base for gaming.
Mm. And before we jump into everything with the business and Media and Games, on this holiday, what would you do then? Because I'm just wondering, what is your interest outside of the professional life?
Yeah, a lot of it is Asia. Not only, but as I said, I did the Japanese studies, got a bit of a taste. I had also a gallery for Asian art for quite a while after my consulting, actually. And I still like to go to Asia. It's the countries are totally different if you go to China or if you go to Indonesia or Nepal. Cultures are different, but it's it's an eye opener. I think I would recommend everybody to travel a lot because you see so many things. You also see people that have basically nothing and are still a lot happier than a lot of people in the mm-hmm. more developed countries. You see a lot of entrepreneurship, a lot of things there. So that's, I have a passion for Asian art, but also for really for traveling and visiting the countries.
Okay.
Cool. I would like to see that Asian gallery, actually, because I'm really into Asian art.
Yeah, you have a lot in common. Yeah, both studies finance and Asian art and Japanese. He loves Japan.
That's cool. Now, I don't have the gallery anymore because you cannot do everything. You have to focus. So I had it for 3 years, was in Rotterdam. Mm-hmm. And we actually had two. It was a gallery for Asian art. And in the cellar, we had a gallery for young Dutch artists, which came from art school. And it was real fun, was a lot of it. And next to it, I also did consulting. And at a certain point, it's too much. So we had a plan to either roll out the gallery also in New York and Hong Kong. Mm. But then I got a good offer to do some big consulting work. And it was not possible to combine everything.
Yeah, the most scarce asset we have in this world is time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So, but it sounds like you really have an entrepreneur journey here. What comes this entrepreneur spirit from?
Good question. It's in me, I guess. When I was a kid, I sold the strawberries from the garden. Mm-hmm. When I was at school, actually, together with a friend, we sold cars, secondhand cars. I've always been doing business. I've had also sold garden chairs and stuff, importing them from Czechia.
Mm-hmm. So you've had not maybe businesses, but you've done some business on the side.
Some hustling.
More hustling in the beginning, to be honest. And,
that's always how it starts, though.
Yeah, and it's you can be very academic, but in the end, it's about selling something. Mm. And also before that, you need to buy it, or better afterwards, actually. And if you don't pay too much for it, if you buy it and sell it, you have a business. Yeah.
But I love that story because I'm not an entrepreneur, but me and my cousins, we took the potatoes, which my grandmother had in the garden, and we sold them as well. Yeah. And I mean, I love to hear stories like that, even though I didn't turn out to be anything. but
you're an analyst.
Yeah. So did you always, not from the start, but did you know you were going to be an entrepreneur? Did you want to be an entrepreneur at a young age?
Yeah, I liked the entrepreneurial part. But when you go to university, and then I did this consulting work at university, and then one of the companies that I consulted for, Kuwait Petroleum, offered me a job at such a good salary. So you get kind of, if you do an academic career, you get a bit corrupted. Mm. You get the golden cage at a certain point where they pay you a lot. You get a nice car, you get a good bonus, you get a good salary. So to jump again and to do a startup or to really do your own business is much more difficult. Then you marry, you get kids, then it's even a bigger barrier. Yeah.
I heard that there's actually a saying from a well-known author called Nassim Nicholas Taleb. He says, there's two great addictions in life, a salary and a heroin.
Yeah.
So it's true what you say.
It's the guy from the Black Swan, right?
Exactly. So it's like you say, you get committed when you have a salary and you get maybe a mortgage and you have good commitment, family, kids.
Yeah, and that was, so let's say I was working, having a good salary with Sonora. Then Sonora overtook itself with a 3G license, had to sell the entity that I was working on. I did the sale together with an investment bank. And then became the COO of the company that acquired it. And that was a lot of, I don't know, politics, non-professionality. So I had something, I really want to do something else. Got some really nice job offers and had something, okay, I need to do my own business. And that's when I jumped and basically took the money that I had. I got rid of my company car, of course. So I lent a car from a friend and you set the whole, let's say the whole business, or you set your whole family also at risk. And my wife has been very supportive in all this. But in the beginning, you put all your money in there. You get some money from friends and family in there. And you start the business. Mm. And it was copy-paste of what I did before. So mobile value-added services, nice word for ringtones, Java games, and these kind of things, old feature phones. But that was fun to
start. So that was your first business you started?
That was my first business that I really started myself.
Okay.
It was in 2005, early 2005.
Hmm. And how did that end? Did you, was it successful in the end or?
Yeah, it was fun because after a half a year after we started, my old boss, the guy that bought the previous company, made me an offer really of several millions, which I didn't take, and euros actually. Mm. And afterwards, I regretted that for a while because it really took time to build up the company. Uh-huh. But we did pretty well. So we listed the company in Germany already end of 2005, so within a year actually. And then really have been building up the company. I run the company for 7 years. We did an acquisition of a large company in the same space. By that, got also large other shareholders in there, got politics into the company. And that was also where I decided I like to work, I like to build things, but I hate politics.
Yeah.
If it's not really about the building the business, but it's about persons wanted to, show that they are better than others and at the cost of others. Mm-hmm. That's no fun. So that's the reason that at a certain point I sold my shares. It was either they sell the shares or I sell my shares. We agreed that I sold mine. Mm. And then, basically this story started because I wanted to do a sabbatical. That was end of 2012. And then got a call from an M&A advisor. Do you want to buy Gamigo?
Okay.
And that's and the start of MGI.
And what was the market value when you sold?
It was pretty well down because also, business was neglected. During my time, the maximum market cap was something like, I think, 40 million euros or so.
Oh, that's a large company.
So, when I sold it, it was substantially lower. I can't remember exactly what it was. But I still got good money out of it. And it's I could have played golf after that every day.
If you wanted, yeah.
Which I like to play golf, but I do 2 or 3 times a year. And for the rest, I rather like to build businesses and do things.
Yeah.
So through this entrepreneurial year or journey you had, what is the biggest lessons you have learned?
All about people. It's all about people. Of course, also about money. If you don't have money to really fund your own business or fund substantial part for it, you are dependent on other people. And then it's again people, with who do you set it up? Who gives you the money? Are they in there for a long time or are they starting to squeeze you at a certain point? In the end, everything burns down to people. If you have a great team that's fun to work with, I'm having the best team I ever had in any of my companies now. And that's really, it's so such a fun and it's such an achievement together to be successful. So people is best. And as said before, no politics, very important that people have a high integrity level, that they're straight. If there's an issue, no problem, but talk about it. So people for me is in all these things, the most important.
Mm-hmm. And what, like based on everything you know today, what would you tell yourself if you could go back 20 years in time?
If I would go back 20 years in time, let me calculate, because I'm doing this now for 10 years, it's 7 years. So it's just 3 years before I started Bob Mobile. Mm-hmm. I would have started earlier, actually. I would have jumped earlier out of the companies, started my own ventures earlier, because it's really rewarding. And I also know that, I mean, it's easy to say because I was 2 times basically successful, or I'm still successful, I hope. And there's a lot of people that start their own business and are not successful. And I've seen really bankruptcies and a lot of trouble also. So it is a risk that you take and you have sleepless nights when the cash flow is not there. So it's not all easy. And so so if you at a certain point have a certain level, it's of course great. But it's a bit also what risk do we have in this society? I mean, how deep can you fall? I mean, the worst case, you go bankrupt and then you start again.
True. We have a safety net.
Yeah, there's a safety net. Mm, yeah. So there's not a big fall. So therefore, risking to be an entrepreneur to do it is
asymmetrical. You have a little downside, but the upside is huge.
Yeah, basically. But there's also a few other things. I mean, you of course, you're totally free, so I could work. I mean, not now anymore, but I could decide to not work every day. Mm. But in the end, if you work more than you would ever work in a normal employment job.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah. And you talked a little bit about it, but what frustrates you most about being an entrepreneur and running your businesses?
bureaucracy, red tape, which we see in a lot in Europe, actually. If I see what's, and if you have certain sites, you have people to take care of it, of course. But but it, especially if you start a business, that's missing. If I look at Europe at all, I think there's no real industry politic. There is no real growth money. So Europe really is putting itself in a not great position at the moment. So there's a lot that could be improved here. But so those are things that I really not like. People that are political, people that are not enjoying what they're doing. I would if you don't enjoy a job, then look for something else. What you enjoy. Life's too short to not enjoy it.
Very interesting that with what you're talking about. Maybe does Europe don't have the kind of network or infrastructure to keep growth companies here, or because in a sense, a lot of them is bought up by American companies. And is that the case?
Yeah, that's what especially happens in tech sectors, I think. First of all, because American companies have so much money and the scale there is also a lot larger. That you see, it's a nice shopping space here. The valuations are lower in Europe. Mm-hmm. And also there is no real alternatives. We see the defense ministry, or let's say the funds of the defense ministry, how many startups they are buying now in electric planes and a lot of more innovative businesses. Also ad tech, there's hardly any company in Europe that left that is doing ad tech. And so as such, Europe is bigger. And also we, if you really look at it, are almost a U.S. company. I mean, 70% of our revenues is in the U.S.
And when you reflect on your life, what have been some of the biggest challenges you faced, professionally? Or, I mean, you can share whatever you want.
Yeah, no, part of it is private, of course, because building this kind of companies, working the way I work, is, of course, you need a wife that really goes along, accepts it, likes it. If you ask my kids, they said, yeah, Papa, you were not that often at home. On the other hand, I have a great relation with them. Mm. But it came also when they were a bit older. So you also have certain things that are not great if you do these kind of things or are less rewarding. It's take and give, or how to say it, finding the balance.
I actually love that answer, because I normally don't hear that from entrepreneurs, because like you say, you only focus on the positive outcome of entrepreneurs or how successful they've been. But I mean, of course, it might have some drawbacks. Like you said, maybe you're not that much at home, which you could have been. So it's actually very interesting to hear that. So,
yeah, and also the downsides in the company. There's hardly any startup really well funded, so you will have this I need more money, or you have sleepless nights for cash flow and these kind of things. Do you really get this next customer? Does it really pay? So there's a lot of things that you also tend to forget, of course. I mean, we're all focusing on the positive things and not so much on the negative, which is good. But being an entrepreneur is also taking risk, and taking risk has also certain downsides.
And a final question about you. It's a little bit silly, I think, but it's a little bit fun. Do you have a secret talent no one knows about?
I have a lot of talents, actually. I wouldn't say it's secret.
but the list for the listeners, it's a secret. None of the listeners knows about. Do you have a specific, your biggest talent?
What I really enjoy, and I'm not sure if it's a talent, but at least I like to build teams. I like to also to coach young people. And that's what you see also in Media and Games Invest. It's a great team. It's really working well together. And so that's one of my passions. And I'm not sure if it's talent, but it's anyway to really build a great team that can bring a company forward, that is innovative, that has a high energy level, is also working together.
Mm. So in a sense, you're working with your passion.
Yes, absolutely.
Yes.
That's for me, what I said before, it's extremely important to do things in life that you enjoy. Mm. Do a job that you don't enjoy, look for another job.
And you mentioned several times during this discussion that you bought Gamigo, and that's how MGI started. So Median Games Invest was born in 2012, if I'm not mistaken. You bought a distressed gaming company from Axel Springer, which is a very large media company, right? Is it German?
Yeah, it's one of the leading media companies in Germany.
Okay.
Yeah, for example, the Bild Zeitung, which is the biggest magazine.
Okay.
Newspaper, actually.
So what did you see in Gamigo at the time? I mean, it was a distressed company, as you've talked about. And what was the vision there? I mean, how did the acquisition come about? How did you came to know about the company? Were you interested in gaming? Why did you acquire this, and how much did you pay for it?
Yeah, I just sold my old my shares in the old company. And I was really a bit fed up because of all the politics and all the kind of things. And so I wanted to do a sabbatical. And then, it's serendipity, as the Americans say, it really happened. So shortly after I had the money in my bank account from selling my share package, I got a call from an M&A advisor we know very well. And he said, Remco, I have something really nice for you to do. And it is Gamigo, a gaming company.
Mm-hmm.
And I told the guy, I'm so fed up. I'm going on holiday. after that, call me back. And then he called me the next day again. I said, Remco, you're really stupid if you don't have a look at this. It's distressed. Axel Springer is a big company. They want to really get rid of it eagerly. They tried to sell it already for a while, and they wanted to just get rid of it. And he gave me a few. I said, okay, then let me look into it. I was already in South Africa, so I had started basically my sabbatical.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't do a lot of points with my wife because then I was on the phone almost daily, several hours with them, and got a company to do the due diligence for me. Also for a friend I know, and told him to look at it, do a red flag due diligence. And basically, within three weeks, I reached agreement with Axel Springer to buy the company, which is, of course, very fast for such a big company. But they wanted to get rid of it.
So really distressed. But why did he call you from every person in the world?
Yeah, like, were you a gamer guy or how?
Yeah, we had also with Bob Mobile / Click Digital, as it was called later, so the previous company, we have also done gaming.
Mm-hmm.
I'm too old. It sounds not very stupid, but I'm too old to be a real gamer. I have not been growing up with games, so I play games.
Mm-hmm. How old are you?
I'm 58 now.
58, yeah.
But it was, I know the M&A guy. He knows me. He knows that I have restructuring experience, that I'm entrepreneurial. He knew that I just sold my shares and was available.
Mm.
And he had something like, I call him and said, this is really something for you.
Mm.
And looking at it, it was a very nice restructuring case because very stable revenues, MMOs, massive multiplayer games, Fiesta, Las Chaos, the games were. In Gamigo were stable revenues, very long-term players in there, and a lot of costs that are not needed. They had 20 games, so the first time, and that was after I bought it actually, I was taking part in a marketing meeting. There were 20 product managers in there, and they were all arguing that their product was great, their game was great, and they got 1/20th of the marketing budget. Mm. And when you looked at the financials of the games, more than half of them were absolutely never getting profitable. So you can easily cut half the marketing budget. They had too many servers. They had, let's say, there was a lot of cost in there. So when I came in, also we reduced the headcount from 120 to a bit under 100. The game was to really make it profitable.
It was basically distressed because they had bad cost control.
They had bad cost control, and they were also betting, and that's what a lot of game companies do. On today, it doesn't go so well, but we invest a lot in new games, and one of them will be the success that goes.
They did the game development.
They did not in-house, but they spent money on external game development. And that's a risky thing, especially for a smaller company.
And how good a deal did you get? What did you? Could you disclose the, what you
paid
for?
They were burning $300,000 to $400,000 per month. So it was a heavy burn, basically. I didn't pay a lot for it. I paid 5,000 euros for it.
Wow.
But there's a but there. There was an earnout structure on top of it. So when I would have turned it around, they would also get some money. Okay. And they also wanted a downward risk protection. So I gave a guarantee, which without having sold my previous company or the shares in my previous company, which I couldn't have done. But yeah. I gave a guarantee for a few million euros because they didn't want to go bankrupt after I bought it, because then it would have backfired to them and they would still have had a cost.
Yeah.
So and, it sounds cheaper than it is, but it was still, I mean, if you look back, it was not a bad deal.
And how quickly did you restructure the business and turn it profitable from being unprofitable?
3 months after I bought the company was break even plus.
Wow. What a turnaround.
It was easy, cutting part of this marketing budget that I talked about, getting some other cost out. Mm. And it had a bit of experience in it, but it was also, the team wanted to go forward. The team also knew that it was not going well with the company. And that's very important if you buy in restructuring case, that you get the team with you, that you, at least those that stay, and even the ones that you... where you terminate a job, you need to explain why you do that. And even if it's not nice, there is a certain understanding for it, not a huge one, of course.
But that sometimes happens, I think, when a large, like a really large company like Axel Springer owns something, it can easily get mismanaged because you don't have a fully focused on that small
segment.
Yeah,
it's not their core business. And exactly. You can't blame, I mean, Axel Springer is doing a great job and is a great company.
Mm.
But this was not their core business. Gaming is also very difficult. It depends on the management. We have seen a lot of other cases that we bought. We bought a game company in the US that had burned $430 million before we bought it.
Yeah.
And then you asked the MD, what do you want to do in the future? And he told me, yes, I'm looking for somebody who gives me $200 million to build a new game.
Yeah.
So this gaming is not easy. It's a different sector. And yeah, we all know there's games that make billions, but there's only a few of those.
From Gamigo to what you are today, you are Media and Games Invest, and that kind of says what you're doing. You are in the ad tech space. How does these parts came about and came together, and how do they work together?
Yeah, it was a bit of my or the team's better said, strategic thinking. So first buying a distressed gaming company and just to grow games, you can do a lot, getting more players in, but also you need to start launching new games. But launching new games and also developing new games is risky. So you need critical mass. So the first thing that we said is we need to get bigger. And the easiest way was to buy companies that are in a similar situation as Gamigo, which are distressed. So we bought also from ProSieben, we bought all their game assets, which is not a big publisher in Germany. We bought assets in the US, companies and assets both. So we did altogether now well over 20 game company transactions, which we bought. By that we built critical mass, by that we got more efficiency by cutting cost. And due to that, we are able to also have a launch strategy, which means that we launch new games. Mm-hmm. We don't develop MMOs because that's still too risky for our size. But we license games and then we launch them. We started with MMOs. More growth is in mobile, so that's also when we pivoted to mobile games. And when we were in mobile games, you see that it's even more risky to launch mobile games, even though the invest is lower. But there's so many mobile games being launched. And to be really successful there, you need to be very strong in user acquisition and you need to be very good in selling the ads. And we were not happy with external parties that we had. If you go to Google, it's a bit of a black box and it's not ultimate efficiency. And there's a lot of, in the open internet, a lot of media companies that are also not necessarily very efficient to work with. So we said, why don't we, and that's again then strategic step number two, why don't we build a media company that would be the ideal media company for a game company, which is basically a media company that's doing the demand side, so the advertiser side, and the supply side, so you can do user acquisition, but you can also sell the ads, and that is doing multi-channel, so it's in-app, mobile web, digital out-of-home, CTV, so that you really cover all the channels where you basically want to advertise for getting players, or also where you can sell the ads. And with the experience we had on buy and build from the gaming side, we basically did the same on the media side, a bit different, because on the gaming side, we were always looking for companies that were similar, because they led to cost savings. On the media side, we looked for companies that were accretive on the technology stack so that they really fit together. We have done now well over 10 acquisitions on the media side. We started it basically when we in 2018 listed the company in Germany. We called it shortly after Media and Games Invest. So then already we had this media vision. We started then with buying, influencer companies, because influencers are very important to launch games. But influencers are a bit like, like the frogs in the bucket. Mm. It's very difficult to control if they get more, successful. Mm-hmm. They're even having more wishes and things. Margins are also not very high. So last year we decided to stop the influencer part, but that was basically the start of the name Media, for the media part of the.
Yeah, and you mentioned it's not as scalable.
No, it's not scalable. Yeah. We were strong we had a good position in Germany, but it was very difficult to scale. And we had a platform, but also even with micro influencers was difficult to scale. So we said, in parallel or a bit after it, we started to buy EdTech. And EdTech is the most efficient thing in on the media side. It is technology driven, so machine driven. So you're not dependent on people. People are very important also there, but you are not dependent once you have customers and the systems run. It runs. And with an influencer, if he has a few bad days, it's a different story.
Yeah.
So we decided to go on to only the EdTech part. And yeah, we never expected that it would be so successful. I mean, you hope it, but you cannot rely on it. And yeah, within the last 3.5 years now, we started 3.5 years ago with building this. First acquisition was actually Applift, which was the majority owner of PubNative, and that was an SSP. So that was the main thing that we were looking for. And then we did Verve Wireless in the US and many more cases. Partly distressed companies, partly successful companies. Smarter was a very big acquisition that we did. Beamray and DMP. So we have really built all those building blocks, accretive together. And instead of supporting the games, what it was meant for, it has become the biggest part of our company now, because there is a lot of need, not only in our company for this, but from a lot of other companies. And it's very scalable.
Yeah, it's very interesting because you had a large base of MMO games, and which are very CapEx heavy. You have to pay a lot of development costs before you launch an MMO, and it might not succeed. But then you counteracted that through acquiring them, so you don't have the development risk.
Correct.
And then you also had mobile games, where mobile games are characterized by low CapEx development cost, but high operational cost because you need the UA.
Yeah.
And then you had the media side supporting with the OPEX and the user acquisition there. So you kind of pivoted several times in the company, like, okay, we need the ad tech or media side. And then the media side grew stronger. And now you're seeing that since you have the media side, mobile games are good because we have the UA and we can support that and we get the first party data. So we can even do ads more effectively. So it's kind of like you reinvented yourself several times.
Yeah, absolutely. But it has also to do with money, of course, money and experience. Because gaming, you can be only a gaming company. And if we would have had a private equity owner, we probably would still be only a gaming company because they would never, support you to really pivot your business model that much.
Exactly.
Or it would be difficult to do. But So from one situation, we saw the need of a gaming company to become more efficient by having this media part, and that it worked so well we couldn't predict, but it does, and so that's really bringing us in the next growth phase. But we couldn't have done this all also without good financing. So I have some money, and that's great. And I've put also later quite some money in. I've also recently bought more shares of the company. But it's all about, if you do these things, I mean, yes, we are not that CapEx intense because we don't, develop games, but we spend money for acquisitions.
Yeah.
And restructuring cases like we bought in the beginning, they're not that expensive, but you still have a bit of cash burn and you have restructuring costs. So they're also not as cheap as they look. But in the last year, we have spent almost 350 million euros on acquisitions. So we are, in that sense, CapEx intense. We couldn't have done that without our listings. And we listed in Germany in 2018, where it was really difficult to convince German investors. And I had a listing experience from before, but the capital market had changed. But really difficult to convince investors about investing in a game company. Games is far away from what they understand. Mm-hmm. That's the reason we went to Sweden. First with a bond, actually, then also with the share listing in 2020. And that was great. Swedish investor understanding gaming, understanding the difference between game companies. Yeah, and then we started pivoting to media company. And then you get a bit of skepticism in the beginning. So why do we do it? And then there is some companies listed here, some media companies here that were not doing so well. So you get also even more skepticism. Mm. And we also have the problem that we have to explain investors what we do.
Mm. Yeah.
EdTech is not something that people here naturally understand. Yeah. And there we see that most EdTech is in the US. They bought most EdTech companies.
Yeah.
And there, when we talk with investors, they understand it. They know AppLovin and IronSource and TradeDesk and so on. So again, here we have made our life a bit more difficult by doing this. For the business, it's great. Towards investors, it's a bit more difficult, or not a bit. We need to do market education. It sounds stupid, but it's...
So it's more about educating the investors what you're actually doing and how beneficial and how profitable it can be.
Yeah, and convincing them that it really is strategically a good move, what we did. Mm. I think the numbers speak for themselves. We have an over 70% CAGR in the last years. So it's going pretty well. Also, the Q2 numbers that we just released are really nice in a market which is much more uncertain than it was a year ago. But it's fun to build it. It makes a lot of sense what we are doing. But you need to explain it to investors. Mm.
And can you maybe talk a little bit about the decision to combine games and media and the synergies? Because you get first-party data from the games and you get the user acquisition cheaper by having the media in-house. So they are supporting each other and creating synergistic effects.
Yeah, each part profits from the other part. So we say our flywheel consists of three parts. The one is the games, so the game portfolio, where we have access to the gamers, where we also make money with item sale and advertising. Then we have the ad tech part, so the technology, which is the demand side, supply side, header bidding. So it's really full bidding programmatic processes in different fields, in-app, mobile web, etc. And then we have the data part, which is extremely important because you have a discrepancy between the advertiser and the publisher. Advertiser wants to pay as little as possible for an ad, and publisher wants to get as much money as possible. And the only way to make that match is by data. So if the advertiser knows that the publisher ad space has more value add for him, he also wants to pay, is willing to pay more for it. And therefore you need data. And those data we get from our games, first party data, but we also have contextual data and different things. And there's a lot happening on the data side. IDFA is being deprecated, cookies are disappearing. So especially the data side is one where we can differentiate our company. And with this flywheel of having the games and also SDK base there, if you have more content, we get more advertisers. If you have more advertisers, we get more publishers. And if you have more publishers, the whole wheel starts running. So you get bigger, you get more efficient, and the whole... The flywheel works.
Yeah, so you're starting to create networks effects with everyone, like combining and having benefits from each other, and then the flywheel is just going and then increasing.
Yeah, so you have economies of scale per definition already in platform, but because of this flywheel of these parts that strengthen each other, if you can do cheaper user acquisition for the game, you get more users in, you have more ad spaces again. So all these things help each other. Mm. And with good ad spaces, the media part can also sell those better because they're unique, they're brand safe. So all these parts strengthen each other or enforce each other.
So you build, it feels like you're building very competitive, a large competitive advantage by being so large and having the network effects. It's a high barriers to entry for a new ad tech player starting from scratch, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I still think that we are too small, so we still need to grow. The bigger we get, the more efficient it gets. The better conditions you get with GCP or AWS, the better, talent you can attract. That's a big advantage already now with the size that we have. We are able now to, where Google and let's say all the big tech were hiring people from us, we now are able to offer them really an exciting environment to work in. So we now suddenly get people from the big tech, for example. It's much easier to get talent into the company.
And when it comes to capital allocation strategy, what's your view on that? It's a shifting landscape now with the macroeconomic environment. The cost of capital is going up, but also acquisitions targets are becoming cheaper. I mean, you have organic growth, M&A, deleveraging the balance sheet, maybe dividends or buybacks, probably not right now. And the options for raising capital is, I mean, raising debt is more expensive than equity as well. So,
yeah, there are two main elements, I think. The one is capital markets, or let's say the whole world around us, that has dramatically changed. If you look at half year, three quarters of a year ago, the world was all perfect, almost perfect. But with the war, with the interest rates, with inflation, capital markets plummeting down, we are in a totally different world. Also having influence on some advertiser budgets that will spend a bit on, less on advertising, gaming after COVID. So there's a lot of things happening in the world where we are strongly positioned for further growth, but which is not perfect for doing capital raises or placing a bond or things like that. So that's one point where I say we are in a new reality, which you just need to adapt to. I think a strong company needs to adapt to its environment. And in this case, we have to adapt. Everybody has to adapt.
Yeah.
The second thing is the company itself. We have, with the M&A that we did, really built now, maybe even just in time, before these market things happened, we built all the blocks that we wanted to build this media company. We are really proving and showing the synergies between those blocks, between within media, but also between media and gaming and data. And it's good for the company to not do further M&A. Of course, there's interesting cases out there, but it's now good to integrate the things that we have. We also shouldn't underestimate, if you do M&A, a lot of our people in the team are involved in due diligence, in the process and stuff. So to really get the team available to focus on the daily business, on building features, on bringing it forward, is basically good timing. So even independent from the market, let's say, changes, as a company, it would have been natural to let's say, do a lot less M&A or no M&A. And we started with only inorganic growth, only M&A growth. We have been starting to build organic growth from 2018, basically. And we are so strong in organic growth now, and we can even do more there. Mm-hmm. So it makes sense to focus on that. So I think those are the two things. Also, with the M&A we did, our leverage is a bit on the high side. So we want to have our leverage between 2 and 3. We're now at 3.7. If you take into account the EBITDA of the acquisitions we did, we would be at around 3.4, I think it is. But still, we are above the 3, and especially in the current markets, that people don't like that.
Yeah,
I think the markets are anyway very short-sighted. They look at the next quarter, next weeks, months, which is kind of, everybody knows that in 2 or 3 years, everything looks different again, or maybe 4 years, but it will come again. What goes down goes up.
Yeah.
Or what goes up goes down. And so it's a different environment, and I like it. It's exciting because in bad weather, it's also easy to gain market share, or let's say not easy, but it's nicer.
Yeah.
So we have a huge opportunity and we can further grow.
And speaking about deleveraging, do you have a plan to lower maybe interest expenses, or is it just to lower the net debt EBITDA ratio by erasing your EBITDA, or are you planning on paying down debt or refinancing, or how?
Yeah, we have bonds, so it's not about paying down, but it's of course about getting more cash in the bank. We have over 100 million cash available in the bank, so it's really, we're cash rich. Only if we would spend it at the moment, we would get our leverage higher up. And raising equity at the moment, I don't think our shareholders would be very happy with that, unless it's maybe a huge opportunity. So that's the reason we say we don't spend the money at the moment, but it's good to have it for opportunities. And on the other hand, we have a strong cash flow from operations, and we use that to delever.
Yeah.
And also, we're looking at getting our money in a bit faster. So there's still optimizations that we can do also on the working capital. So all those things together should bring us very quick in a deleverage. Let's say we are deleveraging already. As long as we don't buy expensive M&A, it is about delevering. But we did a lot of M&A in the last 12 months.
Yeah, exactly. It has been, as you said in your Capital Market Day, which you had yesterday, where me and Dinesh was attending, M&A is not a priority now, but I understand, or I can guessing, it's not out of the question if something comes up that is really interesting and have the right price tag.
Yeah, I think for the next half year, let's say 2 quarters, 3 quarters, I would not expect M&A, but there's always the possibilities. I mean, as an entrepreneur, you need to be also opportunistic at certain mm-hmm. points. So there might be something. But I would rather expect, let's say a lot of targets still are private markets are much higher valued at the moment than public markets. Yeah. So from a point, from that point, it does make sense to buy things. Also, those valuations will go down. So that's a matter of time, I would say, then they adapt more to the public valuations. Plus, we will see more distressed again. Also, that's only starting to come at the moment. And distress is something that we have done, we like to do.
Yeah.
It's not a big capital invest.
No.
But again, as I said before, I'd rather have the team now concentrating on getting the synergies out, adding customers, strengthening our demand side where we still have a lot to do.
So maybe if there are coming a lot of distressed private companies, maybe your expertise in working with distressed companies come up again.
Yeah, but it's the companies now, we are now over 800 people. So it's we have a lot of people that can do restructurings. We have a lot of people that can do integrations. Yeah. So that has changed.
And like you mentioned just recently, I mean, you have all the puzzle pieces in place for organic growth now. So the timing is kind of good anyway for this recessionary environment, because you have a full stack vertically and horizontally integrated media stack right now. And why is this important for MGI if you compare to other media companies like The Trade Desk, which is more or less focused on the DSP side, the demand supply? Why is it so important for you to have the whole value chain here?
Yeah, the world is also there changing. Without identifiers, you need to have transparency, more transparency. And that means basically that you need to connect the advertiser and the publisher within one platform. And Trade Desk is a very strong demand side platform, but also they are going direct to supply at the moment. So we will see this with a lot of companies. There will be a lot of consolidation because of this. As only demand or only supply, you don't have an optimal position in this new world. And no, not all identifiers are out. There are still cookies partly, but a lot of browsers don't support them anymore. There is still the Android identifier, which will disappear in 2024. There's still fingerprinting possible on Apple devices, which will also disappear, even though IDFA has already, let's say the deprecation of IDFA has happened. But there is still some bypassing it with fingerprinting that we expect to change. So there's still, it is changing still the environment, but it's all moving towards, you need more transparency. Because with an identifier, it's easy to work with different parties because you always have the identifier to identify the thing that you throw over the wall. And without an identifier, the world is different. So there's a lot of changing elements that we have. Capital markets, identifiers, these kind of things.
And you own a large stake of the company, 26%, if I'm not mistaken.
Correct.
Yeah.
We are a public company, so that's all public.
Exactly. I was just checking a bit, see if I have my numbers right. And you've done this for a long time. You're 58 years old and you're very financially comfortable. You could play golf all day, like you said earlier. What drives you now and how long do you see yourself staying with the company and growing it?
I like to do things that I enjoy, as said before, and I'm enjoying this a lot. Would you have asked me 10 years ago when I started this that I would do this for 10 years? I would have said, I would have not have believed it. But it feels at the moment like we are only at the start of the company. There's so much potential here. There's so much possible with the company. And minimum 3 to 5 years, maybe longer. The team is great. I was doing a lot of M&A, but we got Sonja joining us lately as CAO. So she is more taking a lot of things there. And M&A is not only buying companies, but it's also managing the earnouts and a lot of things that come there, the synergies. We have a great team. Jens as COO, Paul as CFO, Jonas Samir just joined also, the two tech guys, tech guys. It's a great team. I enjoy it a lot. And I think that we can do a bit more with this company, but need to be careful because we're public.
We attended the after work after your Capital Market Day, and we really saw the team was really comfortable with each other and really enjoying themselves.
And really great people. I mean, both professionally and privately. Yeah. I mean, I really got a good vibe from everyone.
Yeah, it's a very mixed team. People are totally different, but they all have a passion for what we're doing, for building the company. And they, all kind of, they fit well together. Yes. It's a good team.
If you want to know more about your business and do more a deep dive on the business, we really recommend watching the CMD, the Capital Markets Day, which was held yesterday, which was 31st of August, right?
Yeah, exactly. And also, as Dinesh don't want to say it himself, you can also look at his research about Media and Games Invest.
Yeah, that too, if you want to deep dive into numbers and estimates and so on. Yeah, and with that, I mean, we want to thank you for coming here and talking about yourself and your and the fantastic business you've built, Remco. So thank you so much.
Thank you, guys.
Denna podcast är för att informera om Redeyes tjänster. Ingenting av innehållet ska tas som en rekommendation och allt som sägs behöver inte reflektera bolagets åsikter och värderingar. All handel med finansiella produkter innebär en risk. Besök redeye.se för fullständig friskrivning och analys.